It is Monday, March 21st, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. and Cuban presidents engage in an extraordinary news conference in Havana. We'll hear from both leaders and get reaction from our correspondent in the Cuban capital. Our financial reporter tells us why so many investors were watching U.S. consumer electronics maker Apple's new product launch earlier today. And the widow of a Russian intelligence officer poisoned to death in Britain 10 years ago speaks to VOA about why she's determined to pursue her case against the Russian officials whom she blames for the assassination. It's all ahead on International Edition. U.S. President Barack Obama marked the second day of his landmark visit to Cuba by holding an unusual news conference with his host, Cuban President Raul Castro, a man who typically doesn't take questions from reporters. In Monday's appearance before reporters in Havana, Obama and Castro argued publicly but amicably about human rights and their sharply different views of their own countries and the world. After making lengthy opening statements, Castro agreed to take a question from CNN reporter Jim Acosta, who challenged the Cuban leader to explain why he doesn't release political prisoners. This is how Castro responded through a translator.
Give me a list of the political prisoners and I will release them immediately. Just mention a list. What political prisoners? Give me a name or names. Or when after this meeting is over, you can give me a list of political prisoners. And if we have those political prisoners, they will be released before tonight ends.
Well, the two leaders also spoke about how the ongoing U.S. economic embargo of Cuba remains a major hurdle to fulfilling their goal of strengthening their new relationship. Here's what Obama had to say about that obstacle.
The embargo is going to end. When? I can't be entirely sure, but I believe it will end, and the path that we're on will continue beyond my administration. The reason is logic. The reason is that what we did for 50 years did not serve our interests or the interests of the Cuban people. And as I said when we made the announcement about normalization of relations, if you keep on doing something over and over again for 50 years and it doesn't work, it might make sense to try something new.
Well, on the issue of human rights, Obama said he had spoken frankly to Castro about the importance of free expression and democracy during their two-hour meeting just before the news conference. Well, VOA has been covering the Obama visit to Cuba through one of our Latin American division reporters, Celia Mendoza, who's in Havana. I spoke to Mendoza a short while ago, and I asked her what kind of reaction there's been to that rather unusual news conference.
I think it's a very interesting reaction if you kind of see what happened today. We were expecting the same topics to be touched, the embargo, Guantanamo, the economic relationship. However, what happened, the interaction between the president of Cuba and the reporter from CNN, Jim Acosta, where he asked about political prisoners, and it was actually answered by the president with a request of giving him a list of political prisoners so he will be able to release them tonight if that's the case. Gives you an understanding that he usually does not get challenged. He usually does not like to be challenged.
So he basically answered a question with a question.
Correct. And pretty much a challenge of showing him a list of political prisoners. Of course, we will see if Jim Acosta has a list of political prisoners. I'm sure he might have his sources here in the island and can verify that it is a situation. We have had the knowledge that four political prisoners were released before the arrival of President Obama. Three of them had to leave the island. And that's something that it has been widely reported. Now, what we would like to see now is if this reporter has a list and what happens if he's able to give it to the president. He didn't say that he will have contact with him. He says, just give me the list and tonight they will be released.
Well, the Cuban government in the past has challenged this notion, the Western notion of political prisoners. But it seems like many people in detention whom Westerners might view as political prisoners are actually accused of other crimes. Is that the way that the Cuban authorities are able to detain dissidents without calling them political prisoners?
Definitely. That's something that they do. They have they charge him with an actual crime, or what they say is a crime. We have seen it in different situations. Even Alan Grugg, when he was here, he had a case and he went to jail after having the trial in the Cuban court. So it is something that is very particular because, what, as you mentioned, what it will be for us, for the rest of the continent, or for anybody in a democracy or in a traditional democracy, a political prisoner here is not recognized as a political prisoner. That's one of the main reasons why the opposition is pushing really hard to be able to talk to President Obama and to create an understanding of what's happening inside Cuba. Until just a few months ago, international press were not really allowed to come into the island, or not the way that we are being allowed to get in right now. Just the fact that VOA is in Havana, and that in my case in particular is my second trip, is showing you the efforts that they had made. We do have a colleague, partners of our agency, TV Marti, which their reporters are not allowed yet to get into the island. So it shows you that it's still a work in progress, but it's something that is changing because of the opening of the relationships between the two countries.
Thank you very much to VOA Latin American Division reporter Celia Mendoza for speaking with us from Havana.
Thank you.
Well, up next, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, with me in the studio. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So what is the buzz today about this joint press conference between Obama and Castro?
The White House live tweeted the event, so you can check it out on Twitter at White House. And President Obama, or POTUS on Twitter, hasn't sent out a tweet since yesterday when he tweeted about his landing in Cuba. It's quite easy to find journalists to follow to keep posted on his visit just by searching with the hashtag Obama in Cuba.
And that's Obama with an E-N and
that's
then the
right.
word Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so we just heard about the content of the press conference there. What is the online reaction like to a rather bizarre handshake between the two leaders that came at the end?
Right. So to briefly explain the handshake or the arm shake or whatever, it happened when the Cuban leader reached out for Mr. Obama's hand, but actually ended up grabbing his arm instead because of maybe the height difference. So it kind of looks like Mr. Castro is holding up Mr. Obama's hand by holding onto his wrist and kind of flopping it every which
like
way,
that.
Really. So a lot of people are commenting on how awkward it was. And among those who tweeted about it is Matt Drudge. He's an American political commentator and creator of the popular news aggregator, The Drudge Report.
The Drudge Report. Yeah, I was just doing a little demonstration of what that flopping looked like. The Drudge Report is a conservative blog in America, quite a popular one.
Right. And he is on Twitter at Drudge, and the description box shows he joined back in 2011. But he didn't tweet anything until this month, and his first tweet was on the 18th. And the latest of the three tweets is about the handshake. So he made a GIF out of the handshake, and he captioned it, "I am your puppet," and almost 1,000 people liked that tweet.
Ha ha ha.
Very
right?
bad.
So
yeah.
Clearly, he definitely wanted to make his voice heard on Twitter about
mm-hmm.
this. Well, what else is trending on social media today?
So on Facebook, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren's post about GOP presidential contender Donald Trump is gaining a lot of attention. She called him a loser and described him as a serious threat with embarrassing insecurities. Trump responded to that criticism by calling her the Indian at a press conference, referring to her partially Native American ancestry. Back to you, Michael.
Yeah, I think some Native Americans don't like being called Indians. So.
Right, because, yeah, they're not Indians.
Right, so we'll have to see what comes out of that. But thank you very much, G. I'm sorry for making you crack up there. But that is G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And I'm on there as well at Michael_Lippin. And, of course, you can follow our show as well on Twitter. Its account is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Green Beat for a healthier planet. The fishing industry in Mauritania accounts for up to 10% of its gross domestic product. But local fisherman Baro Diop worries his livelihood is in danger.
There are big boats that stop here coming from the sea, big trawlers that destroy the seagrass. And the seagrass these trawlers destroy is where the fish live.
A new global initiative, though, aims to push for more sustainable fishing practices and keep track of the world's fish stocks. Jacqueline Alder is with the Food and Agriculture Organization.
The Fishing Transparency Initiative will help to improve governance by looking at who has the right to fish, how much it costs to fish, and how much they catch.
According to the Fishing Transparency Initiative, overfishing is threatening much the world's fish stocks. Once governments sign on to the voluntary initiative, as Mauritania has done, they must adhere to guidelines for gathering and disclosing information about their fishing industries. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Now for a look at the financial markets. Wall Street is coming off of a five-week rally, and I spoke to our financial reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino, about whether that rally is likely to continue into a sixth week.
Well, the trend in the market is certainly an uptrend. We've been up for 5 weeks in a row, and we have rallied 250 points from the February 11th low in the S&P 500. So the move has been quite stunning. Kicking off the sixth week, we have to remember that it's a holiday shortened week as the equity and bond markets are closed on Friday in observance of Good Friday. So we should expect to see lackluster low volume trade for this week, which is typical of holiday weeks as traders, investors, analysts are preparing for the spring break week. Their kids are off. They might be doing some traveling themselves. So typically tends to be a slow week. We're seeing it in the action today. It's very choppy, lackluster trade.
Are those investors keeping an eye on Apple, the electronics maker?
They sure are. When Apple does a product launch or product update, like they did today in Cupertino in California at 1 o'clock Eastern, traders are paying attention. The media is certainly paying attention. Your gadget geeks are paying attention. And most of what they announced today was telegraphed. It essentially delivered what everyone was expecting. We have the 4-inch iPhone SE starting at $399. That was expected. They took down the Apple Watch to $299, and they came back with the iPad Pro, the 9.7-inch. They reintroduced that. So the hardware end of it was expected. I think what the key is, and analysts seem to reiterate this theme as well, it's not necessarily the new hardware that's going to drive the needle at Apple. It's updating its software and growing their ecosystem. For example, I've had my iPhone for over a year now, but there's nothing new in this hardware update that compels me to upgrade my phone. But because they have their ecosystem is integrated in just about everything, that's how they keep Apple customers within the ecosystem.
Okay, well, thank you very much to our financial reporter, Jill Malandrino, in New York.
Okay, thank you.
The widow of a slain Russian intelligence officer is pushing ahead with a campaign to bring her husband's killers to justice after a British court concluded that the murder was probably ordered by the Kremlin's top leaders. International Edition's Peter Heinlein spoke to Marina Litvinenko, who sees the British verdict in her husband's case as one step on the road to unraveling the mysterious deaths of other prominent Russian dissidents.
Alexander Litvinenko's assassination was nothing if not audacious. A former operative of the Russian Federal Security Service, or FSB, Litvinenko had been granted asylum in Britain in 2000, where he became a vocal critic of President Vladimir Putin. He was said to have been working with British intelligence, providing details of Russia's pervasive organized crime networks and about Mr. Putin himself. On November 1, 2006, he had tea at a London hotel with two men from the FSB, Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun. The tea was laced with polonium-210, a radioactive isotope that is almost exclusively manufactured in a nuclear reactor. Litvinenko died 23 days later after a horrible ordeal. On his deathbed, he dictated a statement accusing President Putin of killing him. He served notice to the Russian leader that a howl of protest would ring in his ears the rest of his life. In the nearly 10 years since, Litvinenko's widow, Marina Litvinenko, has led that howl of protest. She has worked tirelessly to prove that the Kremlin resorted to what she calls nuclear terrorism to silence one of its enemies.
We do understand. They killed my husband by radioactive material, and it was also just presented in this public inquiry verdict. Radioactive material, very high profile, and a very toxic, and you can't buy this nowhere. You can't buy this, not black market, not in pharmacy, not on internet. It could be provided only directly from reactor, of atomic reactor. What makes some sense, it might be just Russia state behind of this crime, because it's two Russian guys. But it's, everything was in discussion, it might be. But this one, now, it's a proof. We have this in this verdict about Russia state involvement.
The verdict came in January of this year, when a British court of inquiry headed by veteran investigator Robert Owen issued a detailed report implicating Lugovoy, Kovtun, and by extension, Vladimir Putin in the assassination. Russian officials vehemently deny any state involvement. Marina Litvinenko doesn't hold much hope that those named by the Court of Inquiry as responsible for her husband's death will be prosecuted anytime soon, given that one is a member of parliament and another is a sitting head of state. But she pledged to continue her howl of protest, partly to highlight what she says is the continuing operation of Kremlin-sponsored hit squads in foreign capitals. For International Edition, I'm Peter Heinlein.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A group of astronomers probing a young star cluster just found a bunch of huge monster stars. The star cluster is called R136 and is located about 157,000 light years from Earth. The group used images gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope to detect dozens of stars with at least 50 times the mass of the Sun and about nine others with more than 100 times the solar mass. The nine most massive of these stars were found to be not only incredibly enormous, but together they produce an extremely bright light that is 30 million times more luminous than the Sun. One of the astronomers said that while some suggest the monster stars were created by the constant merger of smaller binary stars, this doesn't seem to be the case with the supermassive stars in the R136 cluster. Instead, it appears that the road that led to the huge size of these stars may have begun with its formation process. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. A new 8-part documentary about Mariah Carey is leading up to a new tour and another marriage for the American pop star. International Edition's Jim Stevenson talks to VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald to find out what's behind the upcoming film series.
This is a fun item because everything about Mariah Carey is larger than life. And this promises to be the same thing. This week, she confirmed that a new reality show, or docuseries, as they're calling it, is on the way. It's going to be called Mariah's World. It will air on the E! Television Network in 8 one-hour episodes. And it will follow Mariah as she prepares for her sweet, sweet fantasy tour and plans her wedding to her fiancé, who's Australian billionaire James Packer. Now, E! Sent out a press release early this week, and I have to read it because it's just so great. Mm. The series will present a unique, vulnerable, and surprisingly humorous side to Mariah that her fans have never before seen, while showcasing her unparalleled celebrity lifestyle filled with true glamour, maximum luxury, and ultimate stardom.
My goodness, where else can you go from there?
It's lifestyles of the rich and famous. Bubble baths and champagne. That is Mariah Carey. No release date has been announced for the show. Now, Mariah says the series will not include Packer because he's a busy guy. And it will not include her twins because she says that she doesn't want her kids to, be on camera.
Mm-hmm,
so it'll be all about her. Now, Mariah recently changed her management, and this is seen as part of a larger current comeback. And Mariah is very active these days. She's currently touring the UK and Europe. This is her first European tour in a decade. She's going to do 4 South African appearances in late April, and then in June, she will have a residency at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, extending from June 7th through September 11th. And, you know, Mariah Carey is one of those heritage artists mm-hmm. who doesn't necessarily need a hit single or even an album to tour. She goes out on tour and her fans flock to see her. And she's never been a huge touring artist to begin with. So there's been a lot of anticipation here.
The Las Vegas gig is reminiscent of what Billy Joel's been doing in New York at Madison Square Garden.
That's true. And Vegas is a destination of choice for so many of these long-running heritage artists. Celine Dion, Jennifer Lopez, Britney Spears sort of set the template with her fantastically successful Vegas run. You know, it's very convenient for them because they don't have to leave town. The people will come to them. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the wedding goes, this also is going to be spectacular. TMZ says Mariah's upcoming wedding to James Packer will be a private affair. Only 50 guests will be flown via helicopter to the Caribbean island of Barbuda.
No, it's not a Vegas wedding.
It's not a Vegas wedding. No. I mean, you know, they may film one for the TV show with an Elvis impersonator. You know,
or do the drive-through thing.
Or do the drive-through thing, yeah.
Anyway.
But as far as the real wedding goes, she's reportedly getting hitched sometime this summer, probably during her Caesar's Palace residency, during some downtime. Packer is reportedly building a $250 million resort with Robert De Niro.
Why so small?
There might be some useful cross-promotion here.
Yes, absolutely.
Like everything else in Mariah's world, it's big and it's glitzy.
Well, our heritage destination is right here. You join us every week and stop by for the Top 20 Countdown as well. Ray counts it down and he lets you know on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits.
Ray, thanks so much for joining us.
You got it, Jim.
And that was Mariah Carey playing us out on International Edition. Today's show is brought to you by director Tracy Carter and engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. And we hope you have a great week ahead. Thanks.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is committed to promoting religious freedom around the world, including in South Asia. Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom David Saperstein said that while there have been positive developments from both governments and civil society in South Asia, serious challenges remain. In Pakistan, the government has made significant efforts under its National Action Plan to combat sectarianism and violent extremism. However, violence against religious minorities at the hands of extremists continues. In addition, blasphemy laws are still on the books and convictions still occur, with over 20 people currently sentenced to death or serving life sentences for blasphemy convictions. The United States opposes blasphemy laws, apostasy laws, and punishment of conversion laws everywhere. Such legislation is too frequently used to oppress those whose religious beliefs differ from the majority. In India, faith communities are mobilizing to challenge violent extremism. At the same time, India has seen its share of communal violence. One non-governmental organization reported that there was an attack on a Christian almost every day in 2015 in India. Sri Lanka is in the process of drafting a new constitution and is one of the few situations where there has been notable change in a positive direction, said Ambassador Saperstein. January brought the arrest of the leader of Bodu Bala Sena, a violent group that victimized Sri Lanka's religious minorities. In Nepal, ethnic and religious tensions remain, and the constitution includes a provision against conversions. In Bangladesh, extremists have targeted secular bloggers, brutally murdering them. The U.S. is also concerned about an increase in violence against religious minorities and their places of worship by militants claiming affiliation with ISIL. No nation, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said, can fulfill its potential if its people are denied the right to practice, to hold, to modify, to openly profess their innermost beliefs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.